How are you doing? I was just thinking about Alexis Sale, the Liverpudlian comedian, and he used to have a character called Bobby Chariots, who was a stand-up comic who became very popular among students who didn't realise that this really was what Bobby Chariots was like, the comic invention of Alexis Sale. So this classic sort of 1970s stand-up had a catchphrase, "How you diddlin'?" Which is naff beyond belief and pathetic and likely to cause hilarity for all the wrong reasons. You don't realise they're laughing at you rather than laughing with you. So I was thinking about most of the YouTubers and podcasts that I look at or listen to. Most of them have got a standard intro, as in "Let's get into it" or so on. And I was thinking what I could possibly have as a standard intro, and I came up with "Oh Jesus, another day," because this is Bill Murray and Andy McDowell. This is Groundhog Day. Every day it seems to be the same. It's the same COVID stories that we've been running for the last 2 years, but it's not entirely unleavened by other things, some of which are really direct consequences of the COVID crisis, or partly direct consequences, like for example the travails of the Tory government and the rise of Labour, an assisted dying bill going through the Scottish Parliament, and much else, including the difficulties in Scotland of the SNP and their attempts to manage the relationship with the Westminster government, because the COVID crisis is viewed through two very different lenses. One of which I suspect is a genuine lens that corrects vision, and the other is an attempt to pretend that what's self-evidently the case, that we would have been in big trouble had Scotland been an independent country, isn't the case. So, in some ways, everything is the same, and yet if you look closely, it's like fractals. The coastline of Norway is infinitely long because if you look closely enough, every crenellation becomes a trillion other crenellations, and that's a bit what it's like. The political discourse and the positioning of the parties and the difficulties of the country, it all looks the same. But if you look closely, there are differences. If things are emerging, in particular the economy. If something that I so obviously there's a very foolish attitude to the world, which involves claiming you know the future. Martin Amis had the best ever characterization of the bold optimist's view of understanding the world. He described the average working man going into the bookies, trying to predict the future with nothing to help him but the racing post. And I read an article this morning on professional traders in The Guardian, supposedly about the advantages to traders who recognize their emotions. So traders who think they don't have emotions and therefore suggest to researchers that they just dispassionately act, they tend to be worse traders than those who recognize that they're emotional creatures and therefore try to manage their emotions. There's a brilliant Wolf of Wall Street, Matthew McConaughey, Leonardo DiCaprio lunch, where Matthew McConaughey suggests that there's a thing that he does at least twice a day that manages his emotions and ensures that he stays relaxed. I don't think that's quite what the researchers in The Guardian were talking about. But I understand that it's foolish to try and predict the future, particularly when at some level you know you're not confident enough and therefore you don't actually put any money on it. Because, of course, if you really did believe that you had a handle on the future, you'd make a fortune by acting on that. And I don't, and nor do most of those who claim that they know how the world works. So, as I say, I don't know that something bloody awful and big is going to happen soon. But I can feel it in my bones that it might well. This feels as if the elastic has been stretched to the point where suddenly the brick will move. If you try to pull a brick with a piece of elastic, it doesn't move for a long time, and then it moves suddenly. And it feels as if there's going to be something happening, and it's going to happen suddenly because of the tensions that have built up over months, and in this case, years. But so again, I thought I'd have a look at some of the British news stories. And then the Scottish ones in particular, because I think that's less tedious than hearing me go over the entrails of a frog, like some kind of Delphic oracle, looking deeply into the possible motives of somebody like Owen Jones or Polly Toynbee. So just to look at some of today's news stories, Starmer is under pressure to define what he means by socialism because he rejected the opportunity to say that he was or wasn't a socialist. Asked the question, are you a socialist? He said, well, what do you mean by socialism? And of course, you would have thought as Labour leader, he would have thought through what he meant by socialism and therefore would have been able to say whether the best account that he could give was one that he subscribed to, i.e. he was a socialist. Or he could have suggested that one of the possible definitions of socialism was one that he subscribed to, and therefore in that sense he was a socialist. But he didn't. He dodged the opportunity. Now, people younger than me won't remember the troubled history of all this, because the notion of what it is to be a socialist, Marx used the term socialist and communist interchangeably. Socialism and communism, for Marx, are not categorically distinct. The average student who's read a tiny bit of Marx will tell you that communism is the highest stage and that socialism is the intermediate stage, and they'll start boring you about from each according to his work to each according to his work, and then moving on from each according to his work to each according to his needs, and they'll talk about primitive communism. But the reality of the situation is that Marx used the terms interchangeably, and as always, they're sort of stipulative. You have to spell out what you mean by them. In the case of the labour movement in Britain, the socialism of the 1960s and 70s, which was still informed by a proper quasi-Marxist attitude to private ownership of assets, that socialism died. And it died in the 1980s because it was seen to be disastrous in the 1970s. And it was only a rump within the Labour Party, pretty much the same attitudinal rump that kept Jeremy Corbyn in place and led to the 2019 defeat, where ordinary folk were asked to consider whether this kind of Len McCluskey attitude towards private ownership and how economies work, whether that was actually going to be productive. The 1970s involved a Labour government from 1974 that, from the point of view of people like me, had pushed to the limit the idea that government, together with the trade unions and the employers, so-called tripartism or corporatism, the idea that you could actually plan an economy and make the society work by taking the things that you had created by your decisions, like, for example, inflation caused by monetary policy, or the oil price shock if you're on the political left. But of course, as any number of people on the political right pointed out, the oil price shock did not cause inflation in countries like Japan, or only for a short period of time. And the difference was the monetary policy. So the 1970s saw a Labour government for 5 years that promised to manage what earlier Harold Wilson had described as the white heat of the technological revolution. So there would be this tripartite relationship, the three parties being government and the unions and the employers, and they would get together over beer and sandwiches and make the whole thing work. And when negative things happened, like for example inflation, where you could control that with prices and incomes policies, when negative things happened, like businesses closing down because they couldn't sell their products at a price that would cover the cost of making them, then you would have an industrial strategy that would redeploy the assets and redeploy the workers and prevent so-called asset stripping. Jeremy Corbyn's always very keen on talking about undercutting. You don't want workers to come into the country and undercut. So every time you see an evil, you see something wrong in the world, then you want something done about it if you're a socialist, which is exactly how Starmer describes his political philosophy. What it means to be a socialist is to see wrongs and wish that something be done about them. Now, for somebody in the centre-right, that's a really good, crisp, and apparently unarguable commitment, which in actual fact is exactly at the heart of the difficulty that the left has had for 170 years. And again, it's back to my hobby horse, my commitment to liberal conservative political philosophy and the basic beliefs about property and human self-interest, rational self-interest, and the nature of regimes, and why it's important to have a regime that runs with the grain of human nature and tries to produce behaviour which will be socially advantageous, or at the very least not socially disadvantageous. So famously, Hume and Mill and Locke and others have all, and Adam Smith, have carefully taken apart what happens when you take different sets of rules and have rationally self-interested humans organise their behaviour in the face of them. Now, Adam Smith, of course, told us exactly the selfishness of individuals and what it would mean if the butcher and the brewer and the baker were allowed to conspire and raise prices. I think, as Smith says, never do men of the same trade get together without a conspiracy to raise prices. And this is the piece of Smith that people on the left love to reference. What's curious is that they never used that then as a fundamental tenet of the belief system and the great thing they wish to achieve. So they never actually say the most important reason for having a Labour government or a left government is to stop the kind of conspiracy to raise prices, which we see everywhere. Because, of course, there is no conspiracy to raise prices. And when companies try it, they get caught. And it's the easiest thing in the world to catch them doing it because so many lowly employees are involved, cost and management accountants at a fairly high wage, but secretaries as well and others. So you get caught when you try to raise prices, and there's always a tendency to break the cartel or break the oligopolistic relationship and sell at a lower price to maximise your own particular profits. That's why OPEC has such difficulty maintaining the price of oil, because there's always an interest in someone's part to oversupply and take the slightly lower price at much higher output and therefore much higher total returns for the person that broke the cartel. That's why the Saudis are always under pressure to be the swing producer. Everyone hopes that when they overproduce, when Venezuela churns out too much, although I don't think they're part of OPEC, I'd have to check, but when one country overproduces beyond an agreement, then the Saudis will cut back and that will save the rest of the members of the cartel from lower prices because the Saudis will be the swing producer. So it's extremely difficult to organise a conspiracy to raise prices, and there's no evidence that that happens much, and it isn't a central plank of the Labour case. The Labour case is exactly what Starmer says it is, which is there's something happening here that I don't like and I want something done about it. And the trouble is that kind of firefighting approach to the system of government means that you are the sorcerer's apprentice. You never think for one minute that maybe your entire philosophy of government is mistaken. That government isn't that kind of thing. Government isn't a mother running around with a wet cloth wiping egg from faces and running hot baths and putting Wellingtons into outside cupboards and ensuring that sticks are not poked into other faces. That's not the kind of thing that government is. Government is law. And you lay down the laws, and as Hayek said, the laws should be abstract rules that everyone can obey in their actions, aimed at a future and no one to know exactly who will benefit most from the operation of the rules. So classically, don't touch people, don't touch their property, keep your contracts, don't behave like a crazy person in public places. And all of that boils down into respect the autonomy of persons. So that's the fundamental law, respect the autonomy of persons. And if you have that fundamental law and you let enough time pass and you regularly punish those who breach the law so that it's absolutely remorseless in its operation, what you tend to get is commerce and industry and prosperity, and you can tax that productive activity instead of providing good things for the poor. So the socialist project that Starmer doesn't know whether he subscribes to is in actual fact exactly what he defines as the socialist project, which is being outraged by particular wrongs. You see something that you dislike and you want something done about it. And the trouble is when you actually do that with regard to hospital waiting times or shortage of housing or rising gas prices or whatever, when you try and address each of those individual things without giving some thought to how will this particular intervention affect the overall system of rules, which have to be set up to run with the grain of human nature so as to produce as many good outcomes as possible. If you intervene in each of these evils without thinking through how that thing you've done will compromise the total system, then you end up in merry hell. So you look, for example, back at 2007-08, and the housing market collapses. And loads of people have bought houses they can't afford, and they're now going to be repossessed, and they're going to be sold at auction. And that's going to produce bad debt for the banks, because when they're sold off at auction, the price might be markedly below what's owed in the mortgage, and therefore the bank's going to make losses. And what you do then is what Roosevelt did during the 1930s. you become obsessed with a particular evil. You think, oh my God, you know, the banks are going to make massive losses. People are going to have their homes repossessed. It's going to be the most awful thing. And therefore, what Roosevelt did with the farmers and farm products and low prices for agricultural products is that he burned food. He ordered the destruction of food when people were starving because he didn't like the low prices that were produced by the operation of the market when all those farmers took their stuff to market. Now, this is insanity. In exactly the same way that it was insanity to allow the banks to pretend that the loans they'd made against those properties were in actual fact good loans. And the way that we did it was that we, first of all, directly bailed out the banks. We've now got us into a situation where the Bank of England is actually a bond holder. The Bank of England has actually created money out of thin air and bought commercial debt in order to drive down the yield and drive up the price of commercial debt when there's no other bidders in the market. We created a welfare state where nobody wants to own a nightclub, nobody wants to own a restaurant, nobody wants to own shares. What you want to own is a house, because if you own a house and you've no money and it's going to get repossessed, the state will kick in and pay the interest. And at the end of the day, you'll still own the house, and when it's sold at a profit, you'll get the profits free of capital gains tax without any looking back to all of the payments in your mortgage that were made by the state. So we look at a situation in 2007-08 and we think, wouldn't it be terrible if the operation of the market meant that people lost their houses, houses were sold at low prices, banks made massive losses, banks might actually be sold by the receivers to new investors, and that the people who owned the shares would be wiped out. So we look at all these individual evils just as Starmer looks at individual evils, and we want something done about them. And we never think for 2 minutes what that will do to change behaviour. We never think, well, you know, banks will become less careful in making loans now that they know they get bailed out. The executives who run the banks will know that their upside is unlimited and their downside consists of being fired. So they might as well go for bust, go for broke, try everything as risky as possible. And in 2022, we've now got us in a position where, and I was listening to someone this morning who runs a YouTube channel, Heresy Financial. He was pointing out that we've now got a spike in long-term interest rates. And that's the first harbinger of what could be a major problem. It could be that the Bank of England and the Treasury in the US and other central banks have got themselves in a position where they've bailed out every loser with invented money for so long that the world is now awash with money and there's a persistent inflation problem. And if they try to raise interest rates or do anything else, for example, shut down or reduce the scale of purchase of debt, the so-called quantitative easing, if they do anything to try to address the inflation problem, the economy might not take it and it might tank. So they've now got themselves in a position where the economy might be exquisitely sensitive to any inputs at all. And therefore, any attempt to address what could be a looming problem of inflation that feeds on itself. I noticed this morning one of the writers in The Guardian was talking about how to not give the public sector pay rises in line with inflation is a de facto cut, which is true. But to give the public sector pay rises in line with inflation is to give them the means whereby they can drive up prices a bit further. And you end up in this situation of so-called second round effects. A colleague of mine, hi Patrick, a colleague of mine, a previous colleague of mine, said that inflation was entirely caused, almost entirely caused by rising energy prices. And he's right. But the trouble is that the monetary policy is so slack that you get what are called second round effects. You get pricing power, you get a position, you get yourself into a position where people who are making things can raise prices and pass the price rise on. The 1970s, as I say, culminated in 26.8% inflation. People don't remember that. People younger than me don't remember it, and they don't think it can happen. But it could happen. It's one of the reasons why the stock market is still so high. Precisely because the stocks, that especially stocks where the company has lots of long-dated low interest debt. If you think about it logically, if you're the company shareholder and you only have to pay 2% interest on debt that doesn't mature until 2045, once prices start rising, inflation becomes serious, you're not only able to price your goods at much higher prices and get loads of cash coming in, albeit inflated cash, but your interest payments are meaningless. And when you pay off the debt in the future, it'll be meaningless as well. So inflation can really favour the holders of assets over the holders of debt. And one of the reasons why the stock market might be so high, the S&P 500 in America has been extremely high performing. And that might well be because smart people reckon that we could be in a lot of trouble with this debased currency. So as I say, Keir Starmer doesn't know whether he's a socialist or not. I can tell him that he is, because he believes that everything he sees which is wrong needs to be addressed. And by God, that'll cause problems. Prince Andrew has been criticised for the actions of his lawyers. Now, lawyers are employed to do their best for you, and you leave them up to it. The layman doesn't know. A man who's an advocate in his own cause is a fool for a client. Now, the woman suing him, Giuffre, has fought the release of an earlier document that has been sealed and it's now been unsealed at the insistence of Andrew's lawyers in the States. Now, one of the things people don't seem to understand in this whole matter is that it's a civil matter, it's not a criminal matter. The number of people who keep talking about Andrew's guilt or innocence, the guilt and innocence doesn't come into it. I've always had a soft spot for Andrew, so maybe I'm biased. I always think that the difference between a republic and a crowned republic or a constitutional monarchy like ours is that in a republic like the United States, too often the rich escape their civic duties. It becomes an oligarchy. It becomes a country that's run for the benefit of the rich. Whereas, you know, Andrew went to the Falklands and he nearly got himself killed. He was flying his helicopter with a view to, I think, to distracting and causing to deviate Exocet missiles, which sounds fine until you realise that by drawing the Exocet missile away from the ship towards the helicopter, you're drawing it towards yourself, which is why, as he said, he found it for a period of time afterwards very difficult to sweat, because he put himself through such a tremendous amount of fear that his endocrine system wasn't working the way that it should, which apparently can happen. So I have a bit of a soft spot for him. So maybe I'm biased. However, nobody seems to have a kind word to say for what has happened in the last couple of days, because he's been seen to be trying to wriggle out of a civil case. Now, again, the things that you say on matters like this redound to your disadvantage. People don't like it. And it's because they can't think through what it would mean for the rule that they have to advance in order to justify the things they're saying. They can't think through what it would mean. So people say, for example, there was a lawyer on Twitter yesterday saying that people like Giuffre shouldn't be able to agree to be quiet in the future. But you already can't agree to be quiet in the future if you're summoned in a criminal hearing. If you're brought to court on some other matter and you have to give witness evidence, then any deal you've made earlier is not going to be worth a damn. So what he was really saying was that he didn't like the fact that she'd made a deal that might have prevented her saying damaging things about him and initiating further criminal charges or trying to at some point in the future. Now, if you have that as a rule, what it means is that anyone who claims to have been wronged, but they've not been wronged such that it can be proved a criminal standard, because if it could be proved a criminal standard, presumably you'd make a complaint to the authorities and it would be proved a criminal standard, or you have made a complaint to the authorities and they've judged that it can't be proved to a criminal standard. So you end up in a situation where on serious offences, like for example rape, there's a footballer who I won't name, but a footballer, well, is there any point in not naming him because he's all over the place on this issue? But there was a footballer on the East Coast who was charged with rape, and the case was dropped. And if you try to check online why it was dropped, you'll discover you can't, because it seems as if things have been suppressed by the search engines. But I can tell you why it was dropped. It was dropped because a witness came forward after the case was initiated and said that he'd been through the wall where the alleged offence took place, and he gave evidence about what he'd heard through the wall. And after that, the Crown Office and Prosecutor Fiscal Service dropped the case because his evidence would have been so damaging, presumably, to the Crown's case. So it then went ahead as a civil action, which means it's in a balance of probabilities, which means that the judge has to decide whether the pursuer, in this case the girl who said she'd been assaulted by the footballer and his friend, whether she was credible and reliable. And if the judge decides she is credible and reliable, then she succeeds and she's awarded 100,000 in damages. So this is a civil action against Andrew, not a criminal action, and therefore guilt and innocence don't come into it, except tangentially, in that you think if he's liable in the same way that O.J. Simpson was liable for damages for the deaths of Nicole and Ron, which he was held liable. If you think that a civil liability on a balance of probabilities tends to suggest criminal guilt, then in that sense the matter is civil and criminal. But this is a civil matter on a question of damages. And a couple of days ago, the document that had been signed by the pursuer was opened, and it seems to show that she'd agreed to take $500,000 in return for not suing Epstein, who's now dead, or anyone who it might have been included in the action that she raised, any person or legal entity who might have been included in the action that she raised. Now, that would seem to include Andrew, because there were various things said at the time when she was pursuing the action about royalty. People speculated about who it might mean, but it would seem that the period of time where Andrew was alleged to have behaved badly, inappropriately, leaving him open to civil liability, that period of time would seem to be covered by the period of time of where the $500,000 agreement was entered into. So it would seem as if the action can't proceed. But the judge, the federal judge, Kaplan, I think his name is, he didn't seem impressed with the lawyer's arguments. And the matter's going to be decided by the judge in the next couple of days, but it looks as if the case will proceed. But people suggested that Andrew or his lawyers or both were doing something wrong in trying to actually make use of the law, the civil law as it applied. Which is fine. I mean, you can say that they're doing something morally wrong, but you have to cash that out and say what you think is the principle that allows you to condemn them. And is that principle, people who are accused of sexual misconduct should consider the civil cases brought against them to be a special kind of case, and regardless of whether they vehemently reject the claims that have been made against them, they should allow them to proceed and shouldn't use all the tools available in the law in order to prevent the proceeding, when the pursuer will use all the tools in the law to allow them to proceed. Is that what you want to say? So every social worker, every police officer, every teacher, every person who is in any position of responsibility, laying them open to allegations from folk who might be seeking money, shouldn't use the full range of the law which is available to them and which the sovereign parliament has made available to them by either passing those provisions or not repealing them. People in most situations, subject to the most vile allegations imaginable, especially subject to allegations which you would like to reject, repel and defeat, people in that position should make use of what the law provides for people who have been involved in car accidents. So if you're accused of driving carelessly, you can argue that the matter was settled in an earlier agreement and therefore you can't be pursued and nobody will condemn you. But if you're accused of being a social worker who abuses kids, you can't use the provisions that the law allows, because that would be seen to be trying to wriggle off the hook. There was a football manager who'd been a social worker before he was a professional manager, and was accused of the most heinous things imaginable. And it all fell apart because it turned out that the people accusing him seemed to have met in young offenders institutions and so on, which is where, unfortunately, large numbers of kids have been through the social care system end up, or the social work system. So he'd been a social worker and he was recognised when he was a professional football manager. And kids, it seemed, fabricated allegations against him because they discovered the chronology was all wrong. It couldn't have happened because he wasn't there. And it looked very much like a conspiracy against him. So if you want to say, as Marina Hyde in the Guardian does, that Andrew is being far from classy in making use, or having his lawyers make use, or not opposing his lawyer's use of these provisions which are open to him, if you want to say that, okay, cash it out in a principle. What precisely is it you're saying? That the powerful shouldn't defend themselves using the law which the parliament makes open to them? Okay, pass a law that prevents people having access to those provisions in the law and leave them open only to others. Why not have the parliament pass a law Or do you think the United States, states, in this case New York State, should pass laws that prohibit the wealthy having access to some legal provisions that would otherwise be used by the poor in a civil action? So you actually want to leave the wealthy open. You want to leave Elon Musk or whoever, or Bezos or anybody else, open to legal action in circumstances where other people wouldn't be open to legal action. So we're not going to have one rule, one law for everybody. We're going to have different laws that apply to people based on their income. Some people will be more susceptible to civil action than others. Because to return to Keir Starmer, and this idea that something displeases you, therefore let's just do something about it. Well, that can't work as a society. That's not how societies function. There have to be rules. And you either want a situation where nobody, for example, can challenge the jurisdiction of a court, which of course was the first challenge that Andrew's lawyers made. They said the court doesn't have jurisdiction because she doesn't have a reasonable tie to the US. She's living in, I think, Australia. So that was the first attempt. And then the second attempt was she can't sue because she's already agreed not to sue anybody who might have been sued in 2009. And if you want to say that lawyers can't do that kind of thing, okay, cash it out in a rule. Can they not do that kind of thing for anybody? In which case, no civil agreements can take place. Everybody who alleges they've been wronged is going to have to go to court and try to prove that they were wronged. And if they fail, having been offered perhaps $500,000 beforehand to avoid going to trial, they're going to be faced with perhaps millions of dollars in costs, which will bankrupt them. So do you want to say that nobody should be able to accept a settlement when they would like to, because they have to go to trial and have the matter thrashed out, and therefore if they lose on a balance of probabilities, they'll be faced with other side's legal costs? Is that what you want to say? Do you want to say that they should be able to go to trial and that you don't have loser pays laws, and therefore a person might have to spend hundreds of thousands defending themselves to any and every allegation, perhaps by people made of straw, people who can't pick up your bill. So they'll cause you to incur £200,000 to defend yourself. But when you defend yourself successfully, you won't be able to recover it because they won't have any assets and won't have been required to lodge any money with the court against the possibility of their defeat. So you want to have a society where basically anybody who is a nuisance, for example, or wants to be malevolent, wants to damage you, can subject you to a civil action, which, when you win, will have destroyed you anyway because of the money you'll have spent. Do you think doctors can survive that? Do you think you have a medical service? Do you think you can have dentists? How many dentists do you think there will be when anybody and everybody can try it and see whether they can get a load of damages out of a dentist by suggesting they did something inappropriate? But if the dentist wins, then they won't have access to sheriff officers to recover their losses. They won't be able to seize your house because losers won't pay. Folk need to think through what exactly they think, like they champion as a rule. And in the case of the snide remarks made by people about Prince Andrew, they don't really think through what rule underpins their claims. They just say, here's something that strikes me as being unattractive, and therefore I'm going to condemn it and suggest that something needs to be done about it, without ever thinking through what the consequences will be of an action in this case, given that it will form the basis of actions in similar cases in the future. It has to. Unless, of course, you want something completely and utterly capricious, like the rule of a Saddam Hussein. To move on to Scotland, but to stick with the lawyerly theme, the criminal defence solicitors in Scotland have been fighting with the Scottish Government over the payments they receive, mainly for summary defences. In other words, people who are facing up to a year in jail, but usually much less, usually some other disposal. It's quite rare to be jailed for a short period. I wouldn't want to go to jail for a year, but it's quite rare to be jailed these days for short periods of time unless you work really hard to create the situation. Usually there's community payback orders and fines and all kinds of shots across your bows before you finally get locked up. But the criminal defence lawyers get paid a flat fee for most of these summary defences, and then they can bill for other defences. But the amounts of money that are claimed by them mean that the criminal bar, the criminal defence job, is particularly badly paid. And the trouble in Scotland is that the Crown Office, which does all the prosecutions, is increasingly attractive. And it's part of a broader trend in Scotland where the best gig is to work for the state. So the if you're a really good journalist, like I think his name was Andrew Denham, the education correspondent in the Herald. If you're a really good journalist, you're making no money, probably. There's no money in the mainstream media, but you can make maybe £50,000 or thereabouts working as a government information spokesperson or a special advisor for the Scottish Government with an index-linked pension. And if you're going to work in the criminal law, then you want to be a procurator fiscal rather than a defence lawyer. One of my pals from university, should I name him? Yeah, I will. David Clancy. David is the procurator fiscal in Inverclyde. Now, he was a defence lawyer before he was a fiscal, and I'll always remember the soldiers in the Territorial Army who sometimes used him to defend them when they'd been up to shenanigans in Rock Hill, Maryhill, Postle, or one of the other places where they tended to live. They never liked Dave's advice, which was good advice, I'm quite sure, which was, look, you're bang to rights, you know. The best thing you can do is throw yourself in the mercy of the court, and I'll talk to the sheriff and we'll try and I'll talk to the procurator fiscal and we'll try and get some of these things deleted. We'll try and reduce the seriousness of the charge, and we're trying to throw ourselves in the mercy of the court because you are going to get convicted, and the best thing you can do is avoid annoying the sheriff before that happens. But Dave became a procurator fiscal, and then when the OBE for going to Helmand Province and helped set up the legal system there, more nerve than I've got. But anyway, so the procurator fiscal is on a salary, and the defence lawyers aren't. And the defence lawyers have been told they have to be available at all times, pretty much, to deal with the police and to deal with the accused. So the duty solicitor schemes are a nightmare of call-outs and phone calls and harassment. I've got a friend, a former student, who's a criminal defence lawyer, and he basically is talking about jacking in that work and just doing work for people who can pay, jacking the legal aid work, because he's a very good lawyer and he's got a really good business and good relationships with the advocates they often employs to do work in the courts. As he says, the racehorses. So he gets the case ready, and then the advocates often do the work in court. And he would rather deal with clients who pay him quite a bit of money and are so relieved to get a really good defence and charges may be reduced or a decent outcome in terms of what finally happens, even if you're not acquitted, or better still, acquitted, or the case thrown out on some other grounds. So to do a really conscientious job and please the client and get paid a significant sum of money, as opposed to getting paid next to nothing for a hugely time-intensive case, is far, far better for his long-term well-being. Because, like a lot of defence lawyers, he will not contemplate being a prosecutor because he's highly motivated to defend. And people again look askance at that. They'll think there's something amiss. Some people say that they couldn't be a defence lawyer because you're defending the guilty. Well, no, you're not defending the guilty. You're defending the accused. It's for the court to decide whether they're guilty. In exactly the same way that the civil case against Andrew we decided on the basis of the evidence. It's not for the lawyers beforehand to decide. They're not sitting as judge and jury. So the defence lawyers have got an important job to do, and the idea that they're involved in something dubious and that they're all kind of on the side of the accused, they're not. They're on the side of the process, and the final and best word on what a defence lawyer should be, I think, was Clarence Darrow. I think said that when someone, he was talking about the United States, he said when someone is prosecuted in the name of the United States, they've got 160 million against them at the time. So turn of the 20th century, they're 160 million against them. Is it too much to ask that one person should be on their side? And frankly, having seen some of the things we've seen recently regarding criminal prosecutions in Scotland, and I won't name them, but I think we all know which ones we're talking about. When you look at some of the criminal prosecutions in Scotland recently, and you look at some of the criticisms that have been made of the prosecutorial service, and you look at some of the things that have been done in the United States Not often in criminal prosecutions, but in other disciplinary matters, things taken against doctors, some of whom have to then go on and appear in the Joe Rogan show in order to try and get their message across, because the establishment, the broad establishment, to include the mainstream media and increasingly social media as well, doesn't want to actually allow any defiance, any dissent, anything other than their message. When you look at what the forces of the broad establishment are prepared to do, then there is nothing more vital than the professionals who are there to try and oppose them. At the just before Christmas, there was a major disruption in Edinburgh Sheriff Court because a lawyer was threatened with arrest and forced out of the cells in the bottom of the court. And it seems as if what happened was he was speaking to one his speaking to his client and said, "You have to tell the sheriff if you don't, if I won't be able to appear for you because we're working to rule. But if you want to tell the sheriff that you're unrepresented and you don't want to represent yourself, you want to have me, you can do that." And he then turned to the others and said, "You don't have to take the duty person that they're going to try and present you with, this public defender character. I think they're going to try and present you with. You can insist that you want to be represented by somebody else." And so he said that to the cells in general, and at that point, somebody from the tribunal service, the courts and tribunal service, apparently asked the cops to remove him. So, and that caused a major reaction in the Edinburgh Bar, precisely because you cannot have a situation where solicitors have got business and the courts are asked to leave the courts. And it's part of a broader problem that some people have identified in the relationship between the defence bar and the state. And the erosion of the independence of the prosecutorial service in its relationship with the state. I've heard some terrible stories about the way the prosecutors seem to have taken on the garb of the state itself, and by which I mean the Scottish Government, rather than the Crown, the state as opposed to the government, if you like, the continuing state. I will name them. The malicious prosecution against some of the people involved in the administration of Rangers and the buying out of the club. A malicious prosecution. That can't happen. That can't happen in Scotland. It can't happen in any liberal democracy. You can't have a prosecution motivated by malice. You can't have a situation where the Crown recognises that its case is flawed and doesn't drop it. The prosecutor has got a special responsibility to the process, and one that the defence doesn't have. The defence are officers of the court. They have to behave appropriately, but they're there to defend their client against the full weight of the state, the full force of the establishment. The prosecutor has to be separate from the government of the day, and they can't allow themselves to be influenced by any considerations that are irrelevant to the process. They have to be the most important person in court, bar the fact finder, bar the sheriff, or the jury. And as I say, the defence lawyers are up in arms about the fact that they're payments per hour haven't increased in about 20 odd years, and people don't realise that the way the courts function is that lawyers are left hanging around court for huge amounts of time. So what looks like a lot of money, £500 for a summary defence, and it might be a reasonable sum of money if the case is dealt with quickly, is peanuts if it all becomes torturous and goes on for long periods of time and gets continued, and the lawyer's left in a position where they're trying to travel between courts in order to represent clients, and the acid test that the money isn't enough is the fact that they're leaving it. If anyone that thinks they've been paid enough to do the job should contemplate the fact that the world is awash with lawyers and none of them want to do the job. That tells you you're underpaying. And I was watching someone talking about Dr. Fauci, Malone the doctor, talking about Dr. Fauci, and I was contemplating what exactly it is that's causing the attempt to suppress dissent. And someone said, "Let's hope it's only money." And I thought it was a brilliant line. Let's hope it's only money. Let's hope it really is the case that people are trying to prevent dissenting voices are really just trying to maximize profits among pharmaceutical companies, because the alternative would be much, much more sinister. And the same holds true for the underfunding of the Criminal Defence Bar. Let's hope it's just money. Let's hope it's the case that Kate Forbes and Nicola Sturgeon and the rest of them want to spend money on baby boxes that folk don't want, or free bicycles that appear not to get delivered, or iPads that still haven't been delivered, or above market pay rises for college lecturers to get them, keep them on side, or special advisors jobs for anybody who they think they might usefully co-opt. Let's hope that's really what's going on. Let's hope they just don't want to fund the defence lawyers because they don't want to spend the money on them. They want to spend the money on something else. Because the alternative, that they've got another motive for underfunding defence, is a lot more sinister. When I was at Jordan Hill, the teacher training college, there used to be a Scottish School of Further Education, and they offered a 2-year part-time postgraduate certificate in education for further education lecturers, and that was something that you had to do as part of your job as an FE lecturer if you didn't have a teacher training certificate. So I was there between 97 and 99, and one of my colleagues said that the only thing that came out of that process that was useful to him was learning to swim really well because there was a swimming pool at Jordan Hill, so he'd went swimming every day. I don't think it was quite as bad as that. It was okay, but the thing I remember that struck me this morning when I looked at the Herald newspaper was one of the guys there was a former merchant marine officer who was now a lecturer at the Nautical College, Naughty as we used to call it. And Roddy told me a story that made me laugh. Brian Wilson MP, who was a minister as well, and who's writing in the Herald today, Wilson had been visiting, I think it might have been a ship that this guy was on before he was a lecturer, perhaps not. In fact, thinking about it, probably it was something to do with the college. But anyway, Wilson was visiting, and they'd lined up all the officers to shake hands, and behind were all the tradesmen and guys in overalls. So Wilson appears with his entourage, and the officers have got all laid out so that they'll say hello, and then they'll lead him on to talk to the hoi polloi who are ranged behind. And of course, Wilson, being a Labour minister, walked right past them and left them all standing there with these 6 smiles spread across their face, and went and talked to the workers behind before turning back and going and talking to the officers who'd lined up with their regalia on and their caps and all the rest of it. It made me laugh at the time. It's making me laugh now. But you can just imagine the unease and the smile on your face and wondering what you should do now, whether you should turn around and follow them or not, not being quite sure because you've very obviously been snubbed. But if you make it obvious that you know you've been snubbed, that might make it worse. So it's a tremendous social embarrassment. Anyway, Wilson, who is a Labour politician and I suspect isn't putting it on, he means it. He's in the Herald this morning talking about the ongoing fiasco of Scotland's ferries, the commissioned by the Scottish Government and never arriving, and looking as if they never will, at enormous cost, leaving the islands vulnerable to cancellations, not just through COVID but through mechanical breakdown, because it turned out they'd spent the budget that was otherwise being used to keep the most likely spare parts needed in store. So now they don't have these things in store and they have to order them, which means that the delays are yet greater. So the whole thing has been a complete fiasco from start to finish. And Wilson is pointing out that the chap who's just been appointed to the company that owns Carmack, I think Dave McBrain Limited, a chap's just been appointed to head that company. And he's been deeply implicated in the whole business with the ferries from start to finish. And what Wilson is doing is suggesting that the people who appointed him should never have been the panel. They are either civil servants who themselves are hugely involved in the whole disaster from start to finish, or they are Scottish government people who are plainly compromised because they're too closely associated with the government itself, who are being blamed, which has been blamed for the fiasco, or the professional quangocrats, people who just are in large numbers of these quangos and don't really have the kind of public independence. They don't have the perceived independence that would make them appropriate people to make these kind of key appointments. So he's suggesting that the interview panel or the appointment panel wasn't correctly composed and therefore might well be thought to be incorrectly motivated. Because the appointment itself of this guy, Ustergaard, the appointment of him does two things. One, it makes it clear that they think him suitable for appointment, which means that they think him not to be blamed for any of the disaster to this point. And that kind of public exoneration shouldn't be happening, thinks Wilson. And secondly, that the people who appointed him have got every reason to, he thinks, and that certainly when one of the people who appointed him have got reason, maybe not every reason, but have some reason to be pleased by his appointment, because it'll serve to make it less likely that he would say or do anything that might place them in a difficult position. So Wilson's criticising the appointment process of this guy that's just got the job. Now, I don't know whether any of that has got any merit. I don't know whether it's true. This guy is presumably fairly able. It's a defensible appointment, I don't doubt. But it raises a bigger issue, which is appointments generally, particularly to posts where the people making the appointment don't stand to lose much if it all goes wrong. Because, okay, I'm on the centre-right, I'm a rebarbative, knuckle-dragging old Tory of a sort. I'm always lauding, supposedly, the private sector and criticising the public sector without good cause. But it really is important that we understand the issues when it comes to appointment to publicly funded posts or to quasi-public posts, like, for example, the health boards and further education college boards and so on, and positions that might seem arm's length but nevertheless are entirely funded or partly funded by the government. So, for example, some of the third sector organisations that are then influencing the Scottish Government's policy and receiving funding from the Scottish Government. All these kind of appointments in this vast network of public largesse. And it goes all the way down. It used to just be the local authorities and the central state, but increasingly there's any number of good jobs which are kind of quasi-public, like, for example, the housing associations, which are almost entirely funded by public money, either through direct grant or through the rents paid by people who are receiving benefits, or some of the other organisations that stand formally independent. But nevertheless have got huge amounts of public money passing through their hands, like, for example, Scottish Enterprise. So this business of appointment to these jobs where output measures are often very difficult. It's difficult to work out whether the organisation is working well because it's got no competitors. Or if it has got competitors, they're so hamstrung by their funding, their much more difficult funding, that the public sector organisation can coast and still do okay by comparison. Because if you don't have to account for the large sums of money that you're using, it's much easier to wash your face and show that you're supposedly successful. And it goes back to the business of the criminal bar and the funding of the defence lawyers versus the funding of the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service. The criminal bar lawyers have to make their own pension arrangements, fund their own offices, pay everything themselves and try and provide a service for the client who's accused. Whereas the Procurator Fiscal Service and the Crown Office have everything provided for them. And for example, I haven't checked, but I'm pretty sure that they, like teachers, have the same index-linked pension, but that isn't actually funded. So what happens is it's a promise against future tax revenue. So you give people this pension. I looked at my teacher's pension, and supposedly the actuarial value is a bit over £400,000. So it's worth supposedly £400,000. They'll give me £20,000 for 20 years and then I'll die. So the actuarial cost is £400,000. But in actual fact, if you try to buy a pension equivalent to mine on the open market, it's going to cost you well over a million, way over a million, based on the current annuity rates. So the cost of providing a lot of things by the public sector it might be much higher than you realise. I remember many years ago when me and a number of other people were completely sickened by the management of a college where I was working, we contemplated offering the courses ourselves, just cut the management out of it, take the money from the Scottish Government and buy some or rent some little terraced houses and set up classrooms in the houses, and we just deliver the classes on our own because we thought the management were just pure overhead. They didn't contribute anything to the organisation. They were just parasites. And what we discovered was that the Scottish Government would recognise us as a provider as long as the Scottish Qualifications Authority did and we could provide the courses, but they wouldn't give us any of the pro rata capital budget. So all we would get would be the variable money that came in with the student, but the great big block grant that your competitor, the college, gets, you wouldn't get any of that at all. So even if the college was empty, even if you took all the students, they would still be getting a huge chunk of money and a block grant, and therefore you couldn't possibly compete. So we've got us in a situation in Scotland in particular where people who aren't employed by the state are often nearly employed by the state if you look closely. Their supposed independent job, their quasi-private sector job, is in actual fact a public sector job. Now, you could argue that the defence lawyers who work entirely in legal aid are like that, but I think that's a very different thing. I think getting paid by the hour is a very different thing. And to return to the issue that Brian Wilson raises this morning, a lot of people in Scotland are disturbed by leaving to one side this particular appointment. A lot of people in Scotland are disturbed by the appointments that are made and the processes. And there are good academic articles written about how bad appointment processes are, even if you're well-intentioned. So Kahneman, in his book Thinking Fast and Slow, looked at promotions and appointments in the Israeli army and worked out that there was really only two or three characteristics that you needed to look at. And if you looked at those characteristics, you could pretty much predict who was going to be effective. As soon as you have an appointment process which involves interview, you will tend to get people appointed who are like the people doing the interviewing. There's a famous book about the psychology of military incompetence, and the military will typically appoint good-looking men. So if you've got a strong masculine face with a strong jawline and you look the part, you'll tend to get appointed and promoted, despite the fact that, you know, this doesn't really have anything to do with your competence measured in a better method. The classic example being the West Point Military Academy. And I think they look at you for 4 years in the academy, and then they rank you in your class, and then you enter the service and they can look at your final career grade. Now, the lecturers and instructors in the military academy have seen you for 4 years. So they've got a pretty shrewd idea of how good you are. But if you look at the final career rank, you'll discover that the perceived strong masculine face is a better predictor of where your final career rank will be than your performance in the military academy and your graduating point in the class. And the psychology of military incompetence points out that the key characteristic of an officer is the ability to function when exhausted through lack of sleep. All of the sort of screaming and shouting and kicking backsides can be done by the NCOs, but the key thing that an officer needs to be able to do is make a good decision with lots of variables when absolutely exhausted from days of lack of sleep, and that isn't really tested. Knowing what they know about battle and military operations, they don't actually exhaust the applicants and then test their IQ or test their reasoning ability, which is exactly what you would do if you were trying to find out who would be the best employee. So we know our best officer. So we know that recruitment processes are typically quite bad, and they usually result in people being appointed who are quite like those appointing them, which means if an organisation starts to go wrong, it can often go very wrong, because the people who are getting it wrong appoint people like themselves. Now, if you think that's true of organisations that have to sell the things that they produce and pay their own costs and wash their face in a commercial market, competing in principle with every organisation in the world, if you think that's true, how bad do you think it's possible for a public sector organisation to be where it's getting its bills paid by the state and has no effective contributors, free market competition rather? Nobody is able to offer what you offer. Because you're funded directly by block grant from an organisation that is only democratically accountable. Fundamentally, if the Scottish people don't care that ferries don't get built, and then enormous sums of money that have been spent not building ferries would have bought many ferries. If the Scottish people don't care about that and re-elect the Scottish government, then really you can appoint anybody you like to manage Scotland's ferries. Because the gap between the disaster and those who might be held accountable is so large and so poorly defined. There's so little that anyone can do to condemn the people who might be guilty of incompetence or wrongdoing, they're so insulated from any imaginable criticism that they've got no reason to respond. They've got no competitors and they've got no managers. If you're running a health board right now, it's hard to see who it is that's going to condemn you if, for the sake of argument, you're reasonably on side ideologically, politically and in friendly terms with the government. And moreover, the government doesn't have a reason to condemn you because they themselves aren't held accountable by the voters. In that circumstance, you don't really have any... If you're running a health board, you have no competitors from the private sector. My friend is quitting the NHS, a pal who's a nurse, and he's handed in his 4 weeks' notice and he's applied for a job, which I assume he's got. He applied for a job with one of Scotland's few independent health providers. Now, he left because he says it's just dangerous. It's just working in the hospital where he's working, it's just dangerous. The levels of mismanagement and incompetence and you know, often laziness, he can't tolerate because he's quite professional. He's quite, I wouldn't say pious, but he takes his job seriously. Now, as I say, if you've got a state or a quasi-state, if you like, in the case of Scotland, if you've got a state that's got a large public sector and a large quasi-public sector, and the government doesn't feel itself to be under much pressure from the voter, and the organisations that are accountable to the government are under no pressure, therefore, from the government, because the government doesn't feel it has to place them under pressure, because it doesn't feel as if it's going to be punished for their lack of output. In those circumstances, you could end up with quite a flabby state. And luckily, I don't live on Arran or Lewis or anywhere else. But the problems in getting to the islands are, to me, almost a metaphor for the problems in Scotland generally. Anyone that's been in the Scottish public sector as a provider, anyone that's worked, in my case, for a further education college, anyone that's travelled around Scotland and seen the general operation of the further education colleges, anyone who's witnessed just how utterly indifferent most people are to straightforward malpractice and inefficiency and selfishness, the people find it very difficult. There's a Radio 4 programme called File on 4, and it used to regularly go into enormous detail about just how truly appalling the behaviour of a lot of people was. And nothing really came from it, because the public find it boring, and they find that even if they took an interest, there's little they can do. And even if they did the little they could do, the whole public would get the advantage of that improved service, and they themselves would get all the cost. Therefore, it's easier to just walk away. It's easier to go to a different college, to change your doctor's registration, to go to a different dentist, to just tolerate the police officer, to forget about the civil servant's bad behaviour, to forget about the planning application that took forever. It's too difficult to try and address what the state does. I had an Iraqi girl in my class years ago, and I was talking about this so-called ex-inefficiency, this tendency for the public sector to become more inefficient than a comparable private sector organisation would be. And I said, what do you think it's like in a state where essentially everybody is just a little bit half-assed and nothing gets done and it's difficult to make a complaint and nothing sticks? And she started throwing herself around the desk in exasperation, you know, as if she was being taken over by demons. And then she finally spoke and said, it's complete hell. You know, it's absolute hell. And this was because what I was describing was Iraq. And one of the things, of course, as a man of the centre-right, that I think is that given enough time and given enough rope, probably the Scottish government could make a little Iraq of Scotland. Peace.